Hi everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hello, everyone. My name is Brianna Contreras, and I'm editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. Today, I have the pleasure of meeting virtually and speaking with Managed Healthcare Executive Editorial Advisory Board member, Ativ Mehrotra, who is Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy and Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a hospitalist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. In today's discussion, we will get to know Ativ a bit more on a personal level, but also dig in his brain a bit on some of his major career focuses like telehealth, alternative payment models, and price transparency. So without further ado, I'd like to say hello and welcome Ativ.
Hey, Brianna. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
No problem. Thank you for your time today. So to get started, if you could just tell our listeners how you got into healthcare policy and medicine and your role at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess.
Yeah, you know, somebody asked me the other day, why did I get into healthcare policy? And I think the major reason is I get really frustrated very easily. As a doc in the healthcare system, you're constantly, you know, facing barriers like, why can't I do that? Why is that there? Why do I have to discharge patients early from the hospital or whatever other barrier there is? And health policy has always been my outlet as a way in health policy research to both understand what the heck is the underlying mechanisms, to identify stupidity, and then also to try as best as I can to help inform better policy in the future. So obviously trying to help the patients that I serve and, you know, obviously the average American.
Wonderful. Thank you. Now, you've been a member of our editorial advisory board for over a year now, reaching 2 years in October. Not sure if you knew that. So congratulations. So if you could, just briefly, if you could reflect on your time with the publication so far, more so, you know, maybe what you've enjoyed seeing in our publication or what you'd like to see more of.
The publication really does a great job of filling in for me the gap in my work. So let me be a little bit more concrete. When you publish papers, we have a sort of a kind of framework that we do of how to present that data. And it all makes a lot of sense. But the truth is, it's very hard for a busy executive, busy anybody, to read those papers and digest them quickly. And a publication like this, ours, is a useful way of taking those scientific findings and then actually translating that into practically what should be done. And also does a really important job of highlighting for me where, what are executives, the problems they're facing. Because, you know, we get into this business because we want to make a difference, and understanding the latest barriers, issues, struggles that folks in healthcare are struggling with is the best way for me to figure, you know, determine what's the is going to have the highest impact. Wonderful. So personally, it's been great for me.
Awesome. Good to hear. So more so on the topic of, you know, your research and expertise, it seems that much of your research is focused on, you know, healthcare delivery through platforms like retail clinics, e-visits, telemedicine, including their impact on quality, costs, and access to care. So it's obvious to say that telehealth is here to stay, but can you give your thoughts on what that means for in-person care or retail clinics? So for, I guess, a little bit more of a of detail here, it may still be a convenience for many who don't have telehealth access, but in time, could services provided at retail clinics see more of a decline?
Yeah, so it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in this kind of landscape. And so it just to, I'll be a bit more concrete. So you have a person becomes ill, a relatively healthy person has the symptoms, say, of a urinary tract infection or sinusitis, and they're trying to figure out where to go. You know, we are adding continuously new options of care. Urgent care has always been there. Then the retail clinics came along. Now we have these new forms of telehealth. And even within there, we have several options from the synchronous kinds like, you know, American Well, Doctors on Demand, as well as asynchronous kinds such as Lemonade and Hey Doctor. So, you know, it's remarkable the level of choice that the average American has. Certainly with all that competition, it's going to be more and more difficult for to get patients in the door. And I certainly think that, you know, it will come, we will see more competition and fewer patients at some of these sites. But I also want, a theme of my work is that when you make care more convenient, more people will get care. So there's also an expanding market. So that's just one phenomenon. And I don't think that's specific to retail clinics, but across that that area. The other thing that I like to emphasize to people is that we've also, choice comes with its downsides, which is that previously it was kind of easier, right, for the average American. They should I go get care, and if so, I'm going to go to my doctor's office, say. Now they're like, should I get care, and gosh, I don't know where to go. You have this phenomena that patients have to, quote, self-triage themselves in terms of where to go. And so we have a problem that we never faced before. And how is, you know, the average American didn't go to nursing school, didn't go to medical school. How are they supposed to know? And so we need tools, triage tools like symptom checkers and other things to help people. So I think it's just another interesting, you know, with every, you know, a new advance, new problems emerge.
Right, right. Thank you. Now, a bit more on telehealth. Could you fill us in on where things stand as far as the public health emergency telehealth waivers? Are they going to be in effect for the rest of the year? And maybe which of the waiver policies do you believe should be continued or should end?
Yeah. So it's a fascinating. So we keep on kicking the can down the road a little bit. So right now, as of this month, the Congress extended, at least within Medicare policy, which often is, the, as we all know, the big gorillas that kind of impacts other Medicaid, you know, private, other states and so forth. But the Medicare policy is the easiest to follow. And it's supposed to end 151 days after the public health emergency ends. And so if the public health emergency ends in next month, which is scheduled to do, though I don't think anyone thinks it's really going to happen, that means it's going to, if you add 151 days, you get to November, if I've done my math right. Honestly, I think we're likely, the federal government will extend the public health emergency, so there, but there's a lot of uncertainty. And it's been a very frustrating situation for providers and patients, that they don't know what the what it's going to look like after the public health emergency ends, or plus 151 days. There's a really active debate out there about what it should look like. And I think it's important to, many people are like, why are we even having a debate? This has been great. Let's keep it going. And the point that I like to emphasize is that, or at least express the issues are, first, there's a lot of worry about spending. Again, it's an obvious point, but I sometimes feel like it gets missed, which is that if you make care really convenient through telemedicine, it's very advantage of telemedicine, is also going to lead to more people getting care. It's most likely that's going to be the case, though we need some numbers to back that up. And so it's going to increase healthcare spending. And that's fine. A lot of things increase healthcare spending. But then is that additional care resulting in improved outcomes for patients? And that's really what we need. We need the data on how much it's going to increase spending and how much it's improving outcomes, if it is. With that kind of pieces of information, then the Congress, other policymakers, executives can make a decision on when to continue the broad mandate that we have right now or to narrow it down. For example, the strategy by the Congress so far has been to kind of expand incrementally. First, they focused on people in rural communities. Then they said for people with stroke care, And then that was the FAST Act. And then in the SUPPORT Act, they expanded it to people with substance use disorder. And most recently, they expanded it to mental illness. And that's kind of the what I suspect will happen is not a full expansion, but a narrower expansion to select populations. But we will see.
Great. Thank you. Now, what is the evidence so far for telehealth's effect on healthcare equity? Does it exacerbate existing inequities or close the gaps?
Yeah, it's a really critical question. Again, let's lay out the issues. The hope is that the convenience and access would improve the existing disparities in the U.S. healthcare system. But the concern is the digital divide, the disadvantaged populations who may not have either the technology or the lack of maybe the same level of skills would be less likely to have telehealth, and we would exacerbate disparities. So we're hoping to narrow them, but the concern is going to be exacerbated. A lot of research out there on this particular topic. I think and this is a good thing, we have not consistently seen disparities, at least by race and ethnicity, across the US. For example, at least in the Medicare program, Latinos have had the same rate or slightly higher rates of telemedicine use than whites, white non-Hispanics. So that's good. But it's not, they haven't used it more, so it hasn't narrowed the disparity. So it's kind of in the middle. Where the biggest concern that I've seen has been in between urban and rural populations. In the US, as like much of the world, unfortunately, patients in rural communities have less access to care. And that results in, you know, all sorts of differential use, say visits, medication use, et cetera. One of my great concerns is that during the pandemic, it's been quite consistent that rural patients are less likely to use telemedicine. So that existing disparity, I am very fearful, is getting worse.
For sure. And do you see any possible solutions? I mean, I know maybe it's just access to care for those specific patients in rural areas.
Yeah, I think, you know, the easy answer is what's already being pursued, which is broadband availability.
Right.
I think it's hard for me to find someone who doesn't think that that's a really good idea, mm-hmm. Both for healthcare and for everything else in life. And in particular, those really rural communities where they're just not available to us. Obviously, that's been a tough nut to crack. So I don't know the details of this, but it hasn't been that easy, but it's clear. But I do think it goes beyond just having the broadband availability. It means helping patients have the skills to do so. If you sit there on Zoom all day, it's a lot easier to do a Zoom visit. But if you work in a job where that's not part of your day-to-day life, it's going to be harder. So we do also need, beyond just the broadband, providing those skills so that people feel comfortable with those kinds of visits.
Right. Thank you. Now, on the topic of price transparency, in healthcare, it's made some progress, you know, in the industry, and it seems to be more of a focus this year due to the rising demand for improved healthcare experiences. So in your experience, what are some ways to create a price transparency solution that could better assist consumers and the industry overall? That's a pretty, you know, big question, but.
Yeah, no, of course, it's a tough one. You know, first of all, it's hard to argue against transparency, but I do generally tell folks that it's pretty clear in the literature that all the hopes that people have had with price transparency, that it's going to have a transformative effect in the U.S. healthcare system, at least in my research and the research of others, I have not seen that. In general, we have seen that price transparency tools have had little effect on where patients go and get care. As I look forward out there, I think the place to focus, at least one of those things to focus on, is price transparency and targeting it to the providers. Some work that we have ongoing right now, which I'm very excited about, is evaluating the price transparency tool that's targeted to providers for prescriptions. Maybe this can be a way that patients can get lower cost meds if their provider knows how much it's going to cost them out of pocket at the point of care. And so these kinds of solutions, I think, are currently where at least I'm focused on.
Awesome. Great. So for the next one, kind of relating just to cost savings, why is it important for payers to adopt new alternative payment models or value-driven initiatives? And how are these models helping that transition to value-based care?
Yeah. So in general, I think it's widely recognized in the U.S. healthcare system that many of the issues that we face are due to the fee-for-service system. And to the degree that we can move to alternative payment models, we can improve the population health of the and also address costs. So I think, we've talked a little bit about telemedicine. That's a great example where many of the concerns about overuse and increased spending go away if we use some of the new alternative payment models. But the truth is we also recognize that this shift has not been easy. There's all sorts of complexities from an administrative and regulatory framework. And so we know that we need to move in that direction. We just constantly have to be iterating and trying new models until we figure out the models that effectively move us away from the fee-for-service system.
Great, thank you. And lastly, on a more personal note, so outside of teaching and your career, what are some of your hobbies that you've been into lately? Or do you have a favorite movie or show you're currently binging or a book you're into at the moment?
It's interesting. In the last year or two, the pandemic has really changed me on the exercise front. I used to run, but now it's become I've joined a group and we're out there at 5 o'clock in the morning or 5:15 every morning. And it's really been amazing for me because we're all kind of going a little stir crazy. This running group has been critical for my mental well-being, and it's just been amazing. So just to be able to do a lot of things I had never done before, run a marathon recently, ran a half marathon last weekend. So it's been become a huge portion of my life. And obviously both for my mental well-being and now my physical well-being. So that's been my latest obsession in the last couple of years.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. Very awesome. I will let you get back to your day then, but I just want to, take the time to say thank you and thank you for making the time today. And it's been really great.
It's fun chatting with you. Thanks again for your interest.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.